It's time to relax and enjoy Good Sunday. News, sports, entertainment, and much more. Here's your host, Roger Galloway.
Thank you, Shadow Stevens. We have a really interesting show here for you this morning that's all theatrically oriented. And we have two individuals who've done a lot of theater. One of them has done a lot of theater, a lot of movies. And we're going to talk about them and their careers and a little bit of their background and the things that they've done and want to talk about in general. Jordan Killian, who is starring in the Grace Arts Theater production in Lake Havasu City of Carousel, and the great Russ Tamblyn, who starred in the movie versions of West Side Story and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. First off, Jordan Killian. Now, Jordan is currently starring as Billy Bigelow in the Carousel production that is going on at the Grace Arts Theater. Some of you know I'm doing that as well. I've got a relatively small part, and he's got to carry kind of the weight of the show as the lead character. And it's a very important character that has been talked about multiple times over the years in musical theater. Carousel was called by Time Magazine the greatest single musical of the 20th century. It's a little different, and it's a little different from Rodgers and Hammerstein's other shows. Anyway, we're going to find out a little bit about that and the career that Jordan himself is having. He's a young guy, in his early 30s, I would say, right, Jordan?
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about this first. Just getting involved in theater, what possessed you to do that? How did that come about in your life?
Well, you know, I was raised in a musical family. My dad was the minister of music at my church in Oklahoma. Me and my sister, we were born in Texas, but my parents raised us in Oklahoma. And my mom, she played the piano, you know, and taught voice and piano lessons. Just growing up, I was immersed in music from the beginning. So I don't even remember a life without it because it was just always there. In my town, theater really wasn't like a really huge thing. I mean, we had a community theater, but just the opportunities weren't thriving, as I was saying. But it wasn't really until college that my voice teacher, Kim Josephson, he's a regular with the Metropolitan Opera in New York, he really started to plant a seed of just self-confidence, you know, that I had the abilities to perform. I wasn't sure if I wanted to do this or just teach or whatever when I was studying at the University of Oklahoma. He talked me into auditioning for the national anthem at one of the football games. And I was one of three people out of the whole university that got selected for the season. So I was like, okay, maybe there is something to my voice. Yeah. And then later on that next spring, I had auditioned with his encouragement for this Andrew Lloyd Webber production that was like all of the fine arts departments at the University of Oklahoma. And the director, he was from London and had worked with Andrew Lloyd Webber. So it was a really cool opportunity. And I was going up against the musical theater kid. Most of them go off onto Broadway. One of them just was in Some Like It Hot and won a Grammy this weekend. That I did that show with her, you know? It's like that's a really great school for that. And so I was like, man, I'm going to give it a shot, but I don't think I have a chance. You know? For some reason, he saw something and he let me sing Close Every Door from Joseph, which, fast forward, I played Joseph here 4 years ago in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Here, I was 21 when this happened. That just encouraged me, like, okay, maybe I should consider a career in performance, whatever that is. You know, I hadn't really started doing theater yet. That same year, my dad got a job offer at California Baptist University as a voice teacher. My parents decided to move to California. So I was like, I don't really know what I'm doing with my life, but this seems like an opportunity I really shouldn't pass up because there's not many opportunities in Oklahoma. Like, it's either New York or L.A. My second cousin, she's a talent agent in Amarillo, Texas. She got me to do this model and talent expo in Dallas where I sang and read some scenes and did some modeling. We had agents from all over the world there that were scouting. I won best singer and best adult actor for a two-person scene. So I was like, okay, like, this is still signs that maybe I'm doing the right thing for my life. I had about 8 different agents from LA give me their card. So I was like, okay, I really think I should move to California this fall. So I got to California, started to have conversations with some of these agents, but was telling me I should stick with finishing my degree. And I was able to get free education with my dad teaching at Cal Baptist. It wasn't really my vibe, honestly, at the time, but I did start dabbing in community theater. You know, in the beginning it was slow. You know, I was like, oh crap, like I'm like I'm not getting cast like I thought I would be.
You were auditioning but not being cast.
Right. Yeah.
Over and over.
I'd had all this success like
Welcome.
In the beginning back at in Oklahoma, and then it's like, oh gosh, like maybe I made a wrong choice now. You know, for some reason, like I just kept going, and then I started to get some roles. My first like stage role that I got to play was Rolf in The Sound of Music. Yeah. And actually, there's a video on YouTube that has like 130 something thousand views on it, just from a rehearsal from that. People like still go and watch that and comment on it. So that's funny that was like one of my very first roles, and just to like go back and watch that and see how far.
You were thinking seriously about making the possibility of this being a career.
You know, I always try to stay open, you know? Like, I wasn't sure, because, like, in the beginning, I was doing roles just because I enjoyed it, and I wasn't getting paid for it yet.
Okay.
I was just trying to make connections, and a lot of these were community theater roles in the first couple of years, you know? And then, for some reason, I mean, I also have this thirst for traveling. So for a couple of years, I lived abroad. I lived in Scotland and did 6 months volunteering in South Africa, and then I went and lived in Ireland for a year. But while I was there, I got to perform in the cast of Sister Act at the National Concert Hall in Dublin. Yeah. And I was like, okay, I really want to do this again. Missing it. And there was just some unforeseen circumstances back home. You know, my best friend, he'd gotten cancer, and I was like, you know what, I really feel like I need to go back to the U.S. Because at that time, I was like, maybe I just want to keep traveling and be a nomad. You know, I was going to move to Canada or something. But my best friend, you know, I was like, I need to go back. I'm glad I did, because that was the last time I got to see him, because that following spring he ended up passing. But it got me back to California, and I was struggling. I was living out of my car. I was working on a horse ranch, like just trying to make ends meet. My parents had left California at that point while I was living abroad. They'd moved to New Orleans. So I didn't really have anybody. I had a few friends, family friends, that would let me like crash on their couch or whatever, but it was a little rough period, you know. This theater that I was working with, they were having auditions for The Little Mermaid, and I auditioned for them, and they cast me as Prince Eric. I was like, okay, like this is a good start, you know. And then they were like, hey, like we know you need some money, we'll let you teach voice lessons out of our theater, and we think it'll bring good talent to our theater as well.
But there's enough money to live on?
For the time, like to make ends meet.
Then my
cousin moved from Missouri. He had just gotten married, and his wife was wanting to try out, you know, Southern California, and she'd done some theater as well. And so we all were living in a small apartment in Fullerton. It was not cheap, but we were making it. So I just started doing more and more shows, and fast forward. You know, at that point, I was like, I can't do shows for free. I need to like.
We're talking mostly musicals now.
Pretty much, yeah. I've pretty much always done musical theater. Like I've done maybe a couple of plays. And one of them I still had to sing when I did Lend Me a Tenor. Like I still sang opera. Pretty much strictly done musical theater. And then I started to get opportunities to music direct as well. But I also decided to just for a plan B, get my teaching credential just in case. And so I went to Cal State Long Beach, got my music teaching credential. A year later, you know, I was here doing Joseph in 2020, and like less than a month after it had closed, the whole world shut down. At that point, I had like a year and a half worth of gigs. I'd kind of made a name for myself and was working a lot, you know, directing and performing around Southern California. And so I was like, well, what the heck am I going to do now? You know, and you know, I really started to think, you know, I can't travel. I can't teach my private lessons. I can't do shows. Like, kind of like, what's the point? It was a depressing period in my life, I think for most people. But luckily I'd gotten my teaching credential, and I decided to apply for a teaching job. And everybody was on Zoom, but I landed my first teaching job, and that was helping me have an income again. So I'm glad I stuck to my guns and stayed with my education and finished that. It took, what, a year and a half before things started to open up again in theaters particularly.
And would you say that this was true not only where you were, this shutdown of theater was true across the country, and Broadway shut down, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a really bad time.
Right, for sure.
Know?
And My first show coming back was actually Joseph. So the last musical I did before the pandemic shut us down, and then this was in 2020, and then 2021 in the fall I did it at the Candlelight Pavilion in Claremont, California. And so it was kind of interesting that it was like the end and then the start again. You know, you talk about Broadway shutting down. I mean, I remember going like that next spring I went to New York and I saw it was The Music Man with Hugh Jackman. And I just remember sitting there just crying the whole time. One because, you know, it's nostalgia. My parents raised me and my sister on all these classic musicals. You know? So I knew all the music and the story. But just being in live theater, I didn't realize how much it meant to me. We were talking about this yesterday. I mean, I just feel like theater is, it's more than just, you know, getting up and memorizing lines and performing songs and whatever. It's so therapeutic because it's such a reflection of just real life, you know? And I remember when my best friend passed away, you know, I was doing, I told you I played Jesus and Godspell and I did Roger and Rent. And both of those shows, I mean, those were the first two shows they did right after his funeral. And I mean, that was the first time I really realized like how real this is. I remember hugging the disciples at the Last Supper before the crucifixion and Godspell and just crying. You know, these are people I'd only known for like 3 weeks working, you know, but I didn't get the chance to say bye to my best friend, you know, and it just was like such a real moment for me to kind of say goodbye to him through these actors. And I was like, this is what it's about.
And you're doing that right now with your character, Billy Vickler.
Life and death. For sure. And that's why I wanted to do it, because I just knew how powerful it was, not only for like just to tell the story for others, but even just for me alone. I love doing these kinds of roles because they help me reflect on my life and what's important, and also just realizing it's okay to express myself, to be vulnerable and go to those places. You know, I mean, Billy has a whole range of emotion throughout the story, you know, and just dealing with a lot of the trauma he's had in his life and stuff he hasn't expressed, you know, and having to learn and grow. And, you know, that's all you can ask from a human being, you know, is just be open to learning and growing. You all make mistakes, and some bigger than others, you know, it depends on what your perspective is, you know, right? But it's learning to forgive yourself. I think that's a huge part of it. And for me as well, that's something I've really had to learn over the years, is learning to forgive myself more than anything so that I can move forward.
I want to tell people that are listening right now, this is really a terrific production, Carousel, at the Grace Arts Theater. We just opened on Friday night, so we've had two performances, and we're talking here. It's Sunday morning. And we have a performance this afternoon. I think some tickets might still be available for this afternoon. For those, you go to graceartslive.com, and you can see right there what seats are available if you'd sort of like to have you come over and see it. It's a great production. I will say this, that Jordan, you have one of the most remarkable voices I've ever heard. I mean, phenomenal. And people are going to be highly pleased to see you in this role. It's a very difficult role. It's not typical musical. It's not a Curly in Oklahoma, which I think, in my mind anyway, is a much easier role to do.
Yeah.
And this show is really Billy's show.
Yeah.
It's about Billy, his journey, good and bad.
Well,
and he's both a good and bad guy.
I was telling you that I'm going to be actually playing Curly in Oklahoma later on. Later in the spring. And which will be cool because I grew up in Oklahoma riding my horse, you know, through the field singing "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning" and all that, you know. And my first big solo was singing "Oklahoma" at my kindergarten graduation, actually, when I was five.
That's great.
That I really remember like singing. A show like Oklahoma, it's kind of cut and dry. It's like it doesn't go as deep as Carousel does.
Right.
And a lot of times people compare Oklahoma and Carousel because, one, they're written by both Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein.
Right.
And they were written like back to back. Like Oklahoma was their first big one and Carousel was kind of piggybacking off of Oklahoma's success. But Carousel, like I really think Billy is a much more interesting role than Curly is. And I haven't played Curly yet, but yes, right.
Yeah.
Because of the life and death themes that are in this story. And Curly, he's the hero in Oklahoma, but he's just a cocky son of a you-know-what, and he still, and, you know, he doesn't really have much redemption or even, I don't, I don't want to say he doesn't have much of an arc, but compared to Billy Bigelow, you don't have to even know the backstory to realize this guy's been through a lot. You know, He's a rough around the edges guy. And it's like he's so brutal to his wife. And it's like, why should we root for this guy? But there's something about him. I mean, there's moments in the story where you're just like, oh, I get it. Like, he's a human. Yeah. And in spite of all of these things, you know, that he's done and said, he still has those moments where he's like, there's that human side, you know?
Yeah.
And he has the ability to grow and learn from his past, you know?
And the movie was with Gordon McRae and Shirley Jones.
Yeah.
It did not do well at the box office, which is a shame. It's a pretty good movie, but for movie audiences, I don't know, they had some problems with it.
Right.
Difficulty. One of the things I want to talk about a little bit, and you're a good person to give me your opinion on this, is theater. Back in the 70s, people were going to theater a lot, and dinner theaters were springing up all over the country. The Kenley Players in Ohio was an Equity Playhouse. Burt Reynolds got a theater going in Florida. I know there are some really good dinner theaters throughout Texas, for sure. Yeah. And theaters in Orange County were doing great, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then things, you know, people started, I don't know, staying in their home. They stopped going to movies. So we still have audiences in certain pockets of the country. Certainly Broadway, they're still going to theater. And in certain large, Kansas City's got a great repertory.
Yeah.
A theater group, by the way, one of the best in the nation. A lot of people don't know about it, but they do. And Orange County, where essentially where you work, right?
I mean,
that's your. Do you see that's the way it's going to be for another 10, 20 years, or will things change? Are the people
it's hard to predict the future. I would like to think that people will instill that value of going to go see live theater in their kids, you know. But I mean, even now, like I'm a musical director of a theater in San Bernardino, the California Theater of the Performing Arts, and the producers really have to be meticulous about what shows they put in their season, especially for a 1,700 seat house, you know, because when you're paying for the rights of a show, you're basically paying to fill each of the seats in your house. So when you have a 1,700 seat house, that's an expensive show right off the bat, just to get the rights, on top of that, paying your actors, costumes, sets.
And sometimes a production that does well on Broadway is not going to do well in Orange County.
That's true. You have to know your audience.
Chaperone was a huge success in New York, but I think you would have a hard time going somewhere else.
I think, at least in our market, people want to see things they're familiar with.
Yeah.
You know? So, for instance, Disney will do better than most musicals any day, you know? Like we did Beauty and the Beast and The Little Mermaid this last year, and those just they basically sold out, you know? But even musicals that, you know, you think would be that are known and would be popular or were popular at one time not too long ago, say for instance like Rent, which we did well, but it wasn't the like box office smash that we were expecting, you know.
Aren't there some shows that are going to do well forever, like Sound of Music seems to
I would hope so. That's the next one we're doing right now that I'm music directing,
and it's loaded with hit songs.
But you know, it's like we're gonna find out, we're gonna see like if it's still as relevant, because I mean there's you know, I'll sing songs from the Sound of Music to my high school students. I'm a music teacher at a Catholic all-boys high school in Anaheim right now. And, you know, I'll sing and make references to stuff that I just think, of course they would know this, that they are, like, clueless on, you know?
Yeah,
so I'm like, am I just getting old now? Like, you know? Like, I'm 33 going on 34, you know? And, so maybe I'm out of touch. But, you know, so that's something that I try to instill in my students, is just an appreciation for theater, because I mean, where else are they going to learn it, you know? So it's important to instill that in the younger generation so that they can appreciate like how powerful theater can be, you know, and how, like, you know, just not only just how beautiful the music is, but just the how moving these stories can be and how timeless they are, you know.
So Carousel's got a few hit songs, right?
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Busting Out All Over, yeah. If I Love You was pretty relevant and done by covered by a lot of artists back in the day.
Yeah. You'll Never Walk Alone.
Oh yeah,
that one's probably the best song in the show. Yeah, I actually told to the actress playing Nettie the first time I met her, I was like, "You got the best song in the show." You know, I might be playing the lead, but you have the best song.
Yeah, that's for sure.
But you know, and I'll, like when we're singing it at the end, or when they are, I should say. I mean, I'm just moved to tears because just the text alone, like,
well, so much has happened.
I mean, and I just have to think, like, when Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein got together and wrote that, there had to have been, you know, whatever you believe, there had to have been divine intervention in that, because that is just such a beautiful and moving song. I actually, at my previous school I was teaching at, for 2 years in a row, we sang that at our graduation. And I just remember, like, talking to my kids, just tearing up, just saying the text. And it, again, you know, it's like I have to look back at my life and in the ups and downs I've gone through in my life and just thinking, you know, oh my gosh, I'm still here, you know. And, and you know, even, you know, that's that saying, when you hit rock bottom, the only place you can go is up, you know, like, it's going to be okay. You know, that's really the sense of that song, you know, and people need to hear that.
And you get moved. Yeah. I know I've watched you during rehearsals of Carousel here at Grace Arts. During, you know, you get deeply moved just in the rehearsals of both the songs and some of the text that's taking place.
I was bawling after our first rehearsal in several scenes, you know. I was just like, man, and you know, it's just such an honor to be a part of this, you know. I was so impressed with this cast, you know, and it's so fun getting to be a part of this, you know. So I'm really excited to be able to perform this in front of an audience the next 3 weekends.
And know, like, so. You said, you performed here in Lake Havasu before.
Yeah.
Playing Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
And that show did really well, as I recall.
Yeah.
I wasn't
we had great audiences.
Yeah. 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 So you experienced, anyway, the reaction that you get.
Yeah.
The audiences that come to Grace Arts.
Yeah.
And I've been to a lot of the productions.
Yeah.
I've been either in them, or I've watched as a member of the audience, and there's a reaction that is very similar in almost all of them.
Yeah.
Enormous applause.
Yeah.
Standing ovation for every show that I've ever seen.
Wow.
And out of the norm. And I think the reason has to do a lot with, these are people that have come in to live in a community from all over the nation.
Yeah.
They're so grateful
that
there is a nice theater here where people can go and live productions take place that are really good.
The quality, yeah.
So they go, my goodness, I cannot believe, and they just go crazy.
It's like we're not in LA or New York, we're in Lake Havasu City, and we're getting this treat, you know. And and honestly, as an actor, that's, I'm so grateful that they show so much gratitude, you know.
Oh, yes.
Because that's what it's about. I mean, I love being an audience member as much as I love being an actor, you know. I you know, being able to watch somebody on stage just, you know, giving their all and you know, just being vulnerable, you know, you don't as an actor, you have to at times, like, recall upon your past to try to empathize with a character, you know, especially with heavier moments. You know, it's probably easier to be joyful than it is to be vulnerable in a sad scene or you know, something along those lines. And I just, as an audience member, again, it's like that feeling of like, okay, that person understands, and I feel that too, you know. And that helps me not feel like I'm alone. You know, going back to the song, You'll Never Walk Alone, it's like, okay, that person's been through something. I don't know what it is, but for them to give that kind of an honest, truthful performance, you know, and be that vulnerable on stage for complete strangers, you know,
yes.
It's just so moving to me. And I really appreciate that an actor would hone their craft to that point, to be willing to just say, hey, this is me, you know?
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
This is a bit of a devil's advocate question.
All right?
So don't be offended, but I have to ask you.
Okay.
You're confident about your abilities, about your singing ability, your acting ability. I can say, visually looking at you, you're a tall guy, you're a good-looking guy, you can sing great, you act really well in this production, but you don't seem to have the fire in the belly like some of the other actors I know who say, I've got to get to New York, I've got to get to Broadway, I've got to get going, and I want to do movies. You don't have that in you, I don't think. Am I wrong?
You know, I think a lot of it I can contribute to kind of the stuff I've gone through in the past, you know, like in particular, like losing my best friend. And just trying to get to a point of being just content, you know.
Is that enough?
You know, that's a loaded question because, like, as of right now, I'm content. Maybe in a few years that'll change, you know, with other experiences I go through in life and other opportunities that present themselves.
Like, I have to interrupt and say one thing.
Yeah.
Being the age you are, I'll tell you this is how I honestly feel. Being much older than you, I truly believe, somebody told me this once before I reached the age of 30, your 30s. Are the years where you've got to accomplish things, pull it all together, and that will determine the rest of your life. It's your 30s, not your 20s, not your college days. I think that's true.
Yeah.
I think your best years are right in front of you.
Yeah, I honestly, compared to my 20s, and my 20s were great, but there was just a lot of self-discoveries that needed to be made during my 20s, but right now, I just feel a lot more grounded, you know. Mm-hmm. I have, you know, for one, I have a consistent job, or jobs, I should say, because you know, I'm pretty much full-time, and on top of that, full-time, you know.
If you go to New York, you got to start from scratch.
Yeah.
Not easy.
I'm very happy with where I'm at, you know. Like, I love teaching. I love doing shows. I love theater. And I get to music direct. I'm doing 7 shows this spring, so it's a lot. I don't really get weekends or really a day off. But with that, you know, it's helpful that I'm a teacher because then I get all the vacation time, so I can still travel too, which is my other passion in life. So, I'm working pretty hard, you know, all the time. But then, you know, you got to play hard too.
Oh, absolutely. You have a lot on your plate right now, more than I can even imagine someone trying to accomplish. Yeah. Tarzan, you're going to be playing the lead in Tarzan, that's coming up.
Yeah.
You're going to be playing Danny, the lead in Grease.
Yeah.
You've got your music directing, Sound of Music.
Yeah.
Anything else?
We're doing Hello Dolly at my high school, so music directing that. And then we talked about Curly in Oklahoma, doing that in Palm Springs.
So that's coming up. All of this is within the next 5
months. Yeah, and then In the Heights at my theater as well, music directing.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah, and that's all before the end of May.
I keep on thinking you're going to go out on stage. You know, here you are doing Billy Bigelow, and all of a sudden you start
singing the wrong show.
What a Beautiful Morning.
Or Summer Nights from Grease or something. Yeah,
exactly.
Grease Lightning. People ask me, how do I not get confused? I'm like, well, you know, it's like in school, you're studying biology, you're studying math, you're studying English. Do you start doing math on an English test? No, you know what you're focusing on at that moment.
You have to compartmentalize everything.
Yeah. For sure. And you have to prioritize like what to put your focus on. I'm definitely not studying all the scripts at the same time.
Focus is Billy Bigelow.
Yeah. Right now, for sure.
Considering I'm this afternoon, and so far the audiences have been great.
Yeah.
And I know when we get toward the end of the run, we go for a total of 3 weeks, they sell out. And then people are waiting at the doors, and they can't get tickets because they didn't respond fast enough. Today is a great day to go. If not, then move right away to get tickets for the next 2 weekends now, because I'm telling you, I know this, they will sell out, and you'll regret it. It's a great show. It really is. Mm. And it's got wonderful songs. And again, Time Magazine calling it the greatest musical of the 20th century. That's saying a lot. There are a lot of great musicals.
Yeah.
So, and it was also the favorite musical of Rodgers and Hammerstein as well.
Well, definitely, if not their most beautiful score, it's definitely one of their most beautiful scores. And again, the story, it's just, it's challenging, but it's so rewarding too, you know. Again, I just love being a part of this show, telling this story. I feel honored to be asked to be out here again. And yeah, I can't wait to do this, to do more of this.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of fun as well. Jordan Killian, Grace Arts Theater. The show is Carousel. You can get tickets by going to graceartslive.com. And I'm telling you, we're all having a great time. We've got a great cast, lots of fun. What a wonderful way to spend a couple of hours at the theater. So thank you very much, Jordan.
Thank you for having me.
Russ Tamblyn is our special guest. He co-starred in West Side Story as Riff, the leader of the Jets. He also won an Academy Award nomination for the movie Peyton Place, and he co-starred in Seven Brides for Seven Brothers and is the father of Amber Tamblyn, who played the title role in Joan of Arcadia. Russ Tamblyn, terrific guy, wonderful actor, with great stories as well. One of his key movies was Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Let's turn to our special guest, Russ Tamblyn.
When you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, let them do what they can. You've got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. You're home with your own. Company's expected, you're well protected.
If I'm correct, Russ, you got started out in the film business as a kid, and The Boy with Green Hair, is that right?
Yes, I mean, that was my, The Boy with Green Hair was the first film that I was in. Before that, I did tap dancing and used to do some shows around L.A. at women's clubs and the Veterans Administration clubs at the Sawtelle Hospital and stuff like that. So, you know, I was performing, but and then I sort of joined the Screen Children's Guild, and they, I think The Boy with the Green Hair was the first, it was the first film that that I did.
Did you become friends with the lead, Dean Stockwell?
Oh yeah, Dean and I became very good friends on that movie. And then even years later, we moved in together in Laurel Canyon, and I was living with Dean when I met my current wife, Bonnie. We were living together in Laurel Canyon, and I used to hang out with Dean and Dennis Hopper and myself. It's pretty...
Oh, that's a wild group.
Pretty wild group, yeah.
Yes. Were you a dancer before you were an actor?
Yes. I was not like a jazz dancer, but I was a tap dancer. And even before that, I was really an acrobat. I, you know, from the time I was, I don't know, as long as I can remember, 7 or 8 or 9, I always had a gift for climbing trees, and I was a big fan of Tarzan movies, and I was like Gene Kelly, like in The Three Musketeers, where he would swing around things and go down curtains on his with his sword. And so I always loved that kind of moving fast and jumping around fast. I was a jumper and climber and a hanger-oner and never had any fear of heights. So I started out really as kind of an acrobat and as a tumbler, even as a kid. Learned how to do a front flip when I think I was about 8 or 9. And then eventually, you know, took tap dancing and became an acrobatic tap dancer in a way. And that was, that got me started. Then I became an actor. Didn't dance again until a movie called Seven Brides for Seven Brothers.
That's right. And that's one of the movies I really want to talk about, because you played Gideon in that. A great
right.
role. And it was directed by the wonderful Stanley Donen, who did Singing in the Rain, among other things as well. What was that experience like overall?
Well, it was groundbreaking for me, because... I had no idea at the time. I was under contract at MGM as a dramatic actor. I did a movie that I got star billing in that. I only mention that because you can get star billing in several movies, you know, and actually be one of the stars of it, and still nobody, you know, there's people that never heard of you. And so it's not until you get in a big movie And in Seven Brides, for instance, I just was, it was with, it was starring Howard Keel and Jane Powell, and then with Jeff Richards and me, and it was amazing that that movie did more for me than anything else. But I started a movie called A Retreat Hell. Frank Lovejoy.
Frank Lovejoy, yes, yes.
Frank Lovejoy and Anita Louise.
Yes, yes.
And Richard Carlson. This was the group. And I was the fourth star in that. And MGM saw, the director of that movie, by the way, Joseph H. Lewis, he also directed a classic film called Gun Crazy that I was in. And so Joe picked me up to do this Marine movie. And I did that, and he ran it for MGM. Dori Sherry was running the studio then, and they signed me under contract. So I was under a seven-year contract there when Seven Brides was. And I starred in a movie, another one, with Richard Widmark called Take the High Ground.
That's the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah, yes. It was Widmark and Carl Malden, and I got star billing in that. I keep mentioning the star billing because you can star in a movie, you know, and if it's not a really big movie, it doesn't matter so much because... Seven Brides came up, and what happened on Seven Brides is that the choreographer, Michael Kidd, he asked told the studio that he wanted to make, he wanted the six brothers to be great dancers, the seventh, of course, being Howard Keel, who, you know, just sang and it was a star. But he wanted the other six brothers to be great dancers. And the studio, MGM, said, look, you can have four great dancers, and because we have actors that are under contract here, so you can have four great dancers and two of our actors that are under contract, one of them being Jeff Richards, who had been a baseball player and not only couldn't dance, but didn't even like dancers and didn't even like dancing. He didn't even social dance. He hated dancing and dancers. It was that Michael Kidd was stuck with. And they'd already started rehearsal, the four dancers. Jeff and I went over to visit him, at the rehearsal hall. And Michael Kidd came up and said, hey, somebody told me you're an acrobat, that you can do tumbling. I did a backflip for him. He says, oh, fantastic. We'll put it in the number. And I said, wait a minute. I don't want to be dancing with Jacques Dambois from the New York City Ballet and Mark Platt and Matt Maddox, and these guys are just incredible dancers. And he said, this is square dancing, you know, just lift your knees a lot. And so that's how I ended up being in the movie. And after the movie, you know, maybe a couple of months after the movie was released, I was on the cover of Dance Magazine. It just was weird. It just happened really fast.
It's amazing, too, that you were signed as a dramatic actor, and yet you're known a great deal for your dancing and your singing in movies.
Well, that did it, that movie, Seven Brides, right? In fact, most of the people, even in articles and everything, thought that I was just a dancer, that I was picked as a dancer for that movie. No one really realized that I was. But, you know, then too, I had my hair dyed. We all had our hair dyed red for that movie. And I had a hard time explaining to people that I wasn't a redhead for years.
I was going to say, I thought of you at that time as being a redhead for a long time, as a matter of fact.
Well, also I did. They loved the idea that because I got fairly popular with the red hair, you know, I did another movie called Tom Thumb after that.
Yes.
And I was playing such a small character. It was one of my smaller parts.
And, right. There are no small parts, only small actors, right? Not the old line.
But I was so small all the time. I mean, in Tom Thumb, a close-up would be a full-length shot, you know. But most of the time, I was so small that they wanted that blonde, really light red hair again so that I would stand out. And then I did another movie called The Last Hunt, which was I played a half-Indian, half-Irish.
Robert Taylor film, am I right?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, Robert Taylor and Stuart Granger. Mm-hmm. And so I did at least three films where I had red hair around the same time in the mid-50s, and there were pictures of me in movie magazines and always with red hair. And my nickname was Rusty, so, you know.
Oh, and that worked too.
Yeah, so everybody thought,
get that going, yes.
Rusty Tamlin has red hair, you know.
One of the interesting things, when you're talking about dramatic and dramatic roles, there was a very controversial, at the time it was controversial, motion picture made based on a very, very popular book, Peyton Place. You ended up getting an Academy Award nomination for playing Norman Page in that.
That's true.
And very interesting cast. Diane Varsi and Lana Turner and Lee Phillips and Arthur Kennedy, a lot of really fine actors were in it. And what's interesting about that, being an ensemble cast, you're the one who came out of it with the recognition that got that nomination for you.
Yeah, but Diane Varsity got a nomination.
That's right. Yeah.
So, and so did Arthur Kennedy, by the way. Yeah.
Wonderful actor. Yeah.
Oh, and he was a great friend, too.
One of your most famous, if not the most famous role that you did, of course, was in, it won 10 Oscars, West Side Story, directed by Robert Wise, and you played Riff,
right,
leader of the Jets.
Yeah.
That was a tough guy image role for you, wasn't it?
Yes, I actually auditioned for the other part, for the part of Tony, and then at the last minute, my agent called and said, well, Russ, sorry you didn't get the part of Tony, and which would have been opposite Natalie Wood, but they've offered you the part of Riff. I said, really? And he said, yeah, but wait a minute. He said, but MGM has turned it down. They didn't mind you doing Tony, but they don't want you to play this part. And I said, why on earth? It's a great show and a great project. And they said, well, maybe you better go in and see the head of the studio. So I had to go in and see Benny Thaw, who was running MGM then. And I remember when I went in, and I sat down, he said, now look, I know you say you want to do this movie, but we just feel that these are, like, one of the songs you have to sing is Officer Krupke, and you have to sing these lines like, my brother wears a dress, or whatever, you know, my grandma pushes tea. And they said, we just think you have a good reputation here, and that would be really bad for you. And we have put you in another movie that we think will be far better for you, called Where the Boys Are, with Connie Francis. So I actually had to beg him to let me do West Side Story.
When you were doing West Side Story, was a sense that this is going to be a great movie?
Yeah, I think pretty much everybody didn't know it was going to be as great as it turned out to be, but everybody thought it would be a really good film, you know, because it was a great idea. Anytime you can come up with a great idea, which was Montgomery Clift's idea, by the way. He's the one that told Jerry Robbins. But he gave him the idea, and they were at a party in New York together, and Monty is the one that said to Jerry, you know, I've got a great idea for a musical. How about like Romeo and Juliet, but as a musical, but do it with gangs in New York? And he said he couldn't get it out of his mind, and then he got together with a couple of other little show business people, Leonard Bernstein.
Not bad.
Stephen Sondheim. Yeah, it's not bad to get those guys on your side. And Robert Wise, of course, who I used to give speeches for, and Robert Wise, who produced it and directed it. I used to give a speech, and the thing I used to say about him, I used to introduce him at several events, and I would say, this is a man, ladies and gentlemen, that if he never directed a movie, and he directed a lot of great movies.
He did.
Probably no. But if he never directed a movie, he still would have gone down in the annals of movie history because of the simple fact that he was the editor on Citizen Kane. Have that under your belt or in your hip pocket is pretty good.
Pretty good. And of course, he won the Oscar for West Side Story, won the Oscar for Sound of Music. And he obviously liked you. You worked with him again. When people ask me, because they know I love movies so much, and I do, what's your favorite horror movie of all time? I said, well, I don't really like the blood and guts one, but the one that stands out far above all the others is a movie made back in the early 60s, directed by Robert Wise, The Haunting.
Yeah.
And you played Luke in that. Julie Harris was wonderful as Eleanor. It was a terrific, wonderfully directed movie. Was that enjoyable when you were shooting it?
Oh, it was really enjoyable. We did that right after West Side Story. It was Bob Wise's next movie. It was very exciting. It was more fun to make than West Side Story because it was West Side Story was there was so many dancers and so many big sets and such a big deal that The Haunting was like a nice simple little movie about three or four people, you know, in a haunted mansion, and so it was more intimate, and I got to even know Bob Wise a lot better. We'd have dinner, and it was a lot of fun making it and scary at the same time.
I don't know if he edit that movie. Because, boy, the editing on it was phenomenally wonderful.
Good.
Yeah,
I don't know if he did or not. I think he always had an editor, but he had a lot to do with editing because he had started off as such a great editor. You know, one of the things that I remember he said to me one time at I was introducing him. We were sitting at the table at some big event, and I had to introduce him, and he said, now look, Russ, when you introduce me, don't make it too long, okay? He said, keep it short. He says, you can never edit a speech too much. And so I always remembered that. And he said that, and I said, yeah, editing is important, I'm sure. And he says, not only is it important, it's the most underrated It's the most underrated part of making a movie. You know, when you a movie's made, and even at when the awards are handed out, you know, the producer, the stars, the director, the writers, even the music all are like top-notch nominations. But the editor, you don't think that the editor is, it's not that big of a deal. It's underrated. And an editor can make or break a movie the way they put it together, you know? You can take a bad movie sometimes and edit it well and come out with a good movie. And you can take a good movie, and if you got a bad editor, they can ruin it.
He can also make an actor look bad if he wants to, right?
Yes. Yeah, he could. That's right. Always be nice to the editor.
Yes. You've had such a wide and varied career. One of the things I was curious about, you started off with the studio system, with those great old guys that ran the studio system or anything. Things have evolved so much. Movies are much more independent these days than they used to be. Do you think that's better or worse?
Well, I'm not one of those guys that are going to say, oh, in the good old days, you know. Because that's what happened when I was working when I was young and 16 or 17 and working, you know, and they'd say, well, in the good old days, we used to do this back in the 30s, you know, and in the 40s. And now the question is, you know, what did we do in the 50s and 60s? That those were the good old days, it seems like. But it just changes. It just changes and progresses. And you look at a lot of old movies now. I find that my wife and I watch... We watch the Turner Classic movies, the old ones, and love them. But a lot of the old ones are kind of corny at times. I mean, you know, they just are over the top. And take Jennifer Jones, who was considered such a great actress back in the 40s, I guess, and 50s. But if you watch her now in, what was the name of that movie?
Duel in the Sun.
Duel in the Sun.
Yeah, she's like just...
I love that movie.
Yeah. Like way over the top. Way over the top, you know?
Yeah, she was. But that was an interesting... Joseph Cotten and Gregory Peck and... It was nominated too. Didn't win, but it was good.
So I just think that they still are making great movies, and there's some really talented, great directors out there, and...
Obviously, Quentin Tarantino likes you.
Quentin Tarantino likes me, yeah, but oddly enough, he likes some of the worst movies I ever made. he's like one of his favorite movies, and I was waiting for him. He said, you know, my favorite movie that you did of all times, and I thought, well, okay, here it comes. It's going to be Seven Brides or Peyton Place or Son of a Gunfighter. I looked at him. He said, I love that picture. I've seen it 3 or 4 times, and I even have a print of it. And so I couldn't believe it. In fact, the billing that he gave me at the end of Django Unchained, the billing he gave me, and my daughter Amber was in it too, who's quite a good little actress. And the billing that they gave me, and there was just like 4 actors mentioned, and about the actors in the town of whatever the town was, and the townspeople, and it had Don Stroud and somebody else, and then it said Russ Tamblyn as Son of a Gunfighter, and then next to me it had Amber Tamblyn as Daughter of Son of a Gunfighter.
Oh, really? I didn't notice that.
That was our billing.
Wonderful movie, too, by the way. I love that
film. Yeah,
that's interesting that Quentin told you what his favorite movie was that you did. What's your favorite movie that you did?
Well, I have favorite movies for different reasons. I mean, I would think that if I had to pick one movie, let's just say that I could have only have done one of the movies, it would be West Side Story, I think, probably. But it was a lot of work, but I had other movies that I had a lot more fun on, like the Long Ships, for instance, which with Widmark again, with Richard Widmark and Sidney Poitier, because we shot it in Yugoslavia, and it was about Vikings, and the location was incredible, you know, and I just had a lot of fun on it. And I did another little movie called Human Highway that I was in with Neil Young, the singer, the rock singer Neil Young, and Dennis Hopper, and we just had a blast on it. It probably wasn't the best movie I ever made by far.
But you had fun doing it.
But I had fun doing it, so that was a favorite movie of making it. West Side Story was intense. it was you know, a lot of fun at times, but it was intense and it was very hard. Yeah. We were shooting sometimes dancing in New York on cement all day long in the summer when it was, a couple of days it was like 110 degrees. And we're dancing, you know, and I come home at night with shin splints and pain. So I can't say, well, that was my favorite movie to make, you know. But it was certainly my favorite movie as for making a great film.
Do you have your share of movies that you pretty much did for the paycheck? I mean, Eric Roberts has more than a share of those, but are there
oh,
some
yeah.
that you know?
I have, yeah, many. I did a lot of B movies in the. In the 60s, I dropped out and got into fine art as opposed to performance art. You know, in the performance art, my feeling on it was always that in the performing arts, like the stage or films, in the performing arts, you do whatever you can to make the audience's head spin. In fine art, you do whatever you can to make your own head spin, and it has nothing to do with the audience and nothing to do with trying to please who comes to see the art. As long as you like it and it's, you know, something that you that turns you on and makes your head spin and say, wow, look what I did, that's what's important. So those are the two different feelings, I think, that are quite prevalent in as a difference between the performing arts and fine arts. So I got into fine arts in the 60s and started doing a lot of collages and got involved with a lot of the old beat artists from the early 60s, late 50s, the beat generation. Became friends with like Allen Ginsberg and Michael McClure, the poet, is still,
oh, yes. mm-hmm.
still a close friend. George Hearns and a lot of artists, and I still do a lot of art in
We kind of segued over to that, and I knew about that as well.
Yeah.
That's something that
yeah,
you,
so that,
you love doing.
Yeah, so you asked me if I ever did any movies just for the money.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was doing these, oddly enough, while I was becoming more intellectually interested in art and in reading, you know, existential books and everything, at the same time, I didn't care what I did to make money to pay for the rent so I could continue doing artwork because, you know, you can't make a lot of money being an artist. It's the last thing
that's right.
you want to do. So I did a bunch of money, including that a bunch of films, including the Son of a Gunfighter and movies like
that. Quentin loved and cast you in Django,
well,
perhaps
yeah.
because of that. Who
that's
knows?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and also I did another B movie, a motorcycle movie called Satan Sadist. That he loved, and
I got my Screen Actors Guild card, by the way, doing the movie with Ross Hagen.
Oh,
called,
okay.
Called Mini Skirt Mob. That was the first thing I ever did. I shot it down in Tucson. So,
oh, that's funny.
And you work with Ross.
Several films, and yeah. So I did a whole bunch of those movies, but I just kind of did it, you know, with my tongue in my cheek. I mean. I never did them because I thought, oh, this is a great film. I knew it was crappy, but it paid the rent and kept me working in art instead of just waiting around. It wasn't until let's see, many years later, I guess, when I just couldn't get work anymore. Fred Ray was a director too, who used to do these cheap.
Oh, Fred Olin Ray. Yes.
Fred Olin Ray.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the budget was like $100.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. Yeah, I did a bunch of those just for the money.
Just two other questions.
Sure.
Here. One, you're the father of a remarkably talented actress with Amber Tamblyn. She's really, really wonderful. She just did Two and a Half Men and may become a regular in that, I understand, right?
She has become a regular.
Oh, that's great.
She just called, she called my wife Bonnie and myself yesterday, said, guess what, I'm now a regular. She had in her contract that she would be a guest star for the first five shows. And then if it worked out, then they would... they had the option of picking her up as a regular or firing her or doing whatever they wanted. And they, after four shows, she was just great on it. And she is great, and she'll be good in it. They they announced yesterday that they want to pick her up as a regular, and she'll be on the show all season.
Before she got those kinds of breaks and got into the business, did you try to warn her off of it for any reason?
Well, in the early days I did, yeah, when she did a play at her school called Pippi Longstockings.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, it was a school play. It wasn't any big deal, you know. It was like the kids, you know, grammar schools do plays all the time. And your parents come and you see it and you watch your kid either in a recital, you know, play the violin or the cello. Or in this case, we had it's called Santa Monica Alternative School, where Amber was going, and she had a good teacher there, a drama teacher who put on plays, and she picked Amber to do Pippi Longstockings, and my agent at that time, her name was Sharon DeBorg, she was a friend, and she, you know, knew Amber, and so we invited her to come and see the play, and see Amber, you know, and see the play that Amber was in, but it wasn't for any professional reason at all. It was just to see the play. And my God, I can't tell you, but all of a sudden, you know, the kids were coming out and they were like nervous and kind of looking out at the audience. And Amber came on and walked to the edge of the stage and set her lines out like that, you know, and she did the whole part. And it blew everybody away, especially me. I had no idea. And after the play, you know, my agent, Sharon said, "Russ, you have got to let me take her out on some interviews." And I said, no, I don't believe anymore in child actors and letting a child act. It's because they're too young. I want her to grow up first. And she said, and Amber wanted to do it at first. And I said, well, wait a minute. I thought, you know what, if she goes on a couple of interviews and gets rejected, then maybe it'll get out of her system. So she went out and auditioned for a part in General Hospital in the soap opera, and she got it. She among there were like 50 different girls that they tested, and Amber got the part and was on that for years. And from the time she was 14 to 17, I guess.
She was actually 11 when she started.
Oh, 11
and
when she
finished
was starting.
When she was 18. Yeah.
Yeah. So she was
so
on
she was
that for a long
7 years.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Long time.
Long time. It was a great experience.
It was great. It was like a teaching thing for her too.
That's what soaps are. They're great if you can get in there like that. Great teaching experience.
Yeah, especially as a kid, because she worked with professional actors, and she had got a better education because it was just her and another kid in class, you know, and the teacher was right there, and it was a great teacher, as opposed to going and sitting in with a class with 30 or 40 kids, you know. So she learned more, she got a good education there, and a good beginning. She finally, when she left there, you know, then she went on to do Joan of Arcadia, which was a big
show.
Hit for her. And a good
And you did that show, too.
Yeah, I played God, and I said, I should retire after playing God. Also, I said to my daughter, Amber, I said, well, now that I'm playing God, maybe you'll listen to me. And she says, I doubt it.
That's funny.
One last question.
Sure.
You've had this long, varied, successful career, and this is a question I've asked a lot of different celebrities that I've spoken to. It's a little unusual. But if the 8 or 9-year-old Russ Tamblyn, If he was able to come into this room right now, sit right across from you here, and look over and know all of the years that had gone by and what he had become, what do you think about what his thoughts would be on where he is today?
You mean if I'd have known then what I know now?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. I don't know. I've often said that I wish I didn't know then what I don't know now. And I probably would have been, essentially what you're saying, if you had to live your life over, would you change things? And I would have paid more attention. I would have worked harder, I think. I really didn't, I wouldn't have called myself a hard worker. I really did what I liked to do. And I never forced it. It always seemed to be a fun and natural So I think I would have worked harder, maybe just studied more and worked harder on dancing, for instance. I would have done that and not just played around so much, which I did a lot in my life.
When you're a jet, you stay a jet!
Join Roger Galloway and friends next Sunday for more Good Sunday. Have a great day.